Good morning, Valley Forge, King of Prussia and the greater Philadelphia area. This is We the People, the Constitution Matters, and we're coming to you over the Freedom Airways of WFYL. I'm your host, Pastor David Whitney, and I serve as the Senior Instructor at Institute on the Constitution. And with me is my wonderful scholar and gentleman, my collaborator this fine Friday morning, Phil Duffy. And we are in the midst of a series looking at the history of governments from ancient history all the way up until recent times, particularly focused on what our founders of this constitutional republic were learning as they also studied these histories. They certainly spent time studying ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and they spent time looking at English history, and particularly what Phil's going to bring us today, just less than 100 years before the founding of our nation was an event called the Glorious Revolution in England. And that had a particular influence, as he will show, on our founding documents and the whole concept that the people could choose how they were to be governed, or at least choose who was to be ruling over them. And it's important for us to understand the history. And I know a lot of times people kind of glaze over when they hear history. It's like, oh boy, that was one of those boring subjects in high school or college, and, you know, drew them through it. But when you realize that history is vitally important to understand, because the mistakes that have been made in the past, we can learn from those mistakes without having to make those mistakes ourselves. And indeed, that's what our founders were doing as they studied history and looked at the history of governments in times past. They were looking for what worked and what did not work, what was involved in protecting and securing God-given rights, and what attempts have been made to violate God-given rights by human civil governments. And believe me, there are a multitude of examples of human civil governments violating the God-given rights of the people. And so our founders had learned well the lessons of history when they began to construct our constitutional republic. Now, that's not to say that they got everything perfect and they made no mistakes and there wasn't need for some alterations and corrections, but they were working from the model of looking at history to say what would be the best form of human civil government. And indeed, that is a better way to form a government than the way governments are usually formed. You know, there's one group of people that hate another group of people. They go to war and they massacre most of those people, enslave the remaining population. And well, that's how the new government is formed, by force and might of arms. And our founders, again, we did fight a war for independence, but actually that war for independence was involved in securing and establishing that the God-given rights of the people was the purpose for which human civil government is established. And that was their argument with King George III. As King George, you know, your job is really to protect the God-given rights of the people in the colonies. Even if they are called subjects, their rights are given by God, and those rights are to be respected and defended and protected by the king, not abused and violated by the king. And so if you read the Declaration of Independence, you'll find there's 27 grievances that they listed against the King of England as having one who violated those God-given rights. They concluded in that document that this man is unfit to be the ruler of a free people because of his violations. And therefore, we need a government that will secure and protect God-given rights. And it's important to understand that, because today, those same God-given rights are under assault in so many directions. We could talk about 2020 and the, I would call, the crimes of the COVID era. Many, many crimes committed against the rights of we the people, such as forced injections, injections given without proper informed consent, which, by the way, is a violation, as we've said previously, of the Nuremberg Code that says human experimentation cannot be done unless the person fully consents and is fully informed of what they're entering into. So the issues that were in play when our founders established this constitutional republic are still in play today, and perhaps even more so, and vitally important for us to understand them as we seek to restore our freedoms and restore our constitutional republic. Well, while Phil has been looking at the secular history, I've been walking through the scriptures, particularly the early parts of the Bible, Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy as well, because God did give human civil government an ideal formation. And that was given at Mount Sinai. Last couple of weeks, we looked at the Ten Commandments as the foundation of that law that God gave to his people. And it's important to note that while we have three branches of government, God's Hebrew Republic did not have an executive branch in the sense of someone that was there as king. God told them that he was to be their king. And they were not to have a human king. God was their king. And if they obeyed him and followed his law, there would be wonderful blessings in the land. Also, there was not a legislative branch in the sense of creating new laws at all. In fact, the laws given, the first five books of the Bible called the Torah, which is the Hebrew word for law, it was the law. And, you know, they didn't need anybody else to invent or come up with any new laws. It was all there. And basically, the only branch of government then that really in the Hebrew Republic was the judicial branch. That is looking at cases and controversies that arose among the children of Israel and saying, okay, we've got the law of God. Here it is, these five books, and we're going to apply that law of God to the cases and the controversies that come before us. Now, it's interesting in the structure that was established by God at Mount Sinai, there was four levels of appeal in that structure. And then there was an ultimate level appeal. You might call it the Supreme Court of the Hebrew Republic, but there was four levels of appeal that are described in Exodus chapter 18, verses 20, 21, and 2. And it was this, that for every 10 families, there would be one person appointed by those 10, chosen by those 10. So there was an elective process of, involved in choosing the person who was going to be their judge for those 10 families. And then there was another level. If a person felt that they were not given justice by the judge of the 10 families, then they could appeal to the judge of the 50 families. So for every group of 50 families, there would be a judge. And then for every group of 100, there would be also a judge. And then for every group of 1,000 at that level. Now, if all four levels were gone through in terms of the appeal process and a person was dissatisfied at each level, that they received justice, then they were to go to Moses, kind of as the Supreme Court of their system of justice. So that whole idea that is part of our constitutional republic of the opportunity to appeal a judgment that's handed down in court, appeal it to the next level, comes directly out of scripture, directly out of this Hebrew Republic model that was given. Now, the Hebrew Republic not only involved a judge who would oversee the case, but it also involved a jury of one's peers. Yes, there was one judge, but the jury of one's peers would be what in scripture is called the congregation or the assembly of Israel. And this assembly was important to hear the case and to also render a verdict that the judge would then apply. So in that system, one of the vitally important things is that the people who are going to be serving as jurors were educated in the law of God. They couldn't walk into a court ignorant of what the law said. You know, if the law said, thou shalt not steal, and, you know, stealing somebody else's land, for example, by moving a property boundary in order to pretend that the property boundary was further over and you're stealing land. Well, the person who was going to be part of a jury, as well as the judge, obviously, they had to know the law that in Deuteronomy 27, verse 17, it says, cursed is anyone who moves his neighbor's landmark. So there was clear establishment that to steal property by moving a landmark was a crime that brought curses, brought punishment, brought penalty. Obviously, justice would be established when that landmark was restored to its proper position. And the land that had been stolen was restored to the proper owner of that land. And so in the Hebrew Republic, education of the law was extremely important. It was so important, in fact, that God established 48 cities scattered throughout all 12 tribes. So each tribe would have three to four, maybe five cities, depending on population. But in each of these cities, these were Levitical cities. And the Levites were the tribe of Israel involved in the conducting of worship in the tabernacle originally, and later, of course, in the temple. But the Levites were also to be experts in the law of God. And the reason why God scattered them in 48 cities throughout Israel is that their job was to educate the Israelis and the Hebrew people, that is, to educate them about the law of God. So everyone would have a Levite nearby And that Levite's job was to help train everybody in what the law of God said, the first five books of the Bible, therefore with an educated population, then the people knew what the law of God is. And so if they're called to serve on a jury and hear a case and controversy brought into court, they would know what the standard was by which the judgment was to be rendered. Is this person violated something that is actually a law? Have they violated the law or have they not violated? We have a friend, Heather Idoni, that is currently incarcerated in federal penitentiary for supposedly having violated the law called FACE, Freedom of Access to Abortion Clinics. And so she was not preventing anybody from entering, but she was there witnessing and singing and sharing literature and doing everything that the First Amendment of our Constitution assures that you have the right to do, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, et cetera, all those First Amendment rights. She was merely exercising that, but she's been imprisoned and now she's being threatened with 34 years incarceration for having done that at three separate abortuaries. And, you know, this FACE law, if the jurors knew that they had the duty to evaluate whether this law was lawful or unlawful before they rendered a guilty verdict, obviously, if somebody's claim that they violated a law, but the law they supposedly violated is not a law, what our founders called in the Declaration of Independence, a pretended legislation, then obviously they have not committed a crime. Our founder said that the king repeatedly passed pretended legislation and therefore offenses of these pretended legislations. These were pretended offenses. They were not real crimes. And so FACE is not a legitimate federal law. If you look at it, the federal government in our Constitution is given no authority, no jurisdictional ability to say what happens outside an abortuary. States could do that. Counties could do that. But the federal government, it's none of their business. They have no business involving themselves in what happens in the activity outside an abortuary. It is outside their jurisdiction. Nothing in the Constitution grants them that. And therefore, that law completely is unconstitutional. And knowledgeable jurors who understood the law, understood the Constitution, would have said, she's innocent because this law is not a law. It's pretended legislation. And so in Israel, it was extremely important that the Levites do their job and do their job well of educating everyone on what the law was. And our framers of our constitutional republic believed that would happen, that would happen in the private schools of these United States, and that would happen in the tutoring of students, and that would happen in the homeschools. And then later, of course, people said, oh, of course, we're going to train people to be good citizens by the public schools. Oh, but how's that gone? What a disaster that has been. And so the average American knows almost nothing about our founding documents because they have not been taught anything about them, either in the public school or in many private schools as well. And we are working at Institute on the Constitution to educate hundreds of thousands of homeschoolers with a homeschool curriculum that we've produced, because we know that it is essential to restore the republic, that the education of those principles be inculcated in the youth. And indeed, that was why God established the system of the Levites, who would, being scattered in 48 cities around the nation of Israel, would be diligently instructing each and every citizen so that that citizen could fulfill their role when they were called upon in that role as a juror when a case or controversy was brought into court. So the other thing we need to understand about the Hebrew Republic that's critical is it was highly decentralized. In essence, there was no ongoing top level, what we would call federal government. There was none. The only time something came together that united all 12 tribes in an action would be when it was war. And if you read through the book of Judges, God would raise up a warrior to lead the children of Israel. So Gideon was raised up. He led the children of Israel successfully in battle against the Midianites, this famous midnight surrounding the Midianite camp and all that you can read in scripture. But at the end of that war, the people were so enamored with Gideon. It's like, wow, man, this is a great hero. He has gained us the victory. We need to make him our king. And you read the text of scripture, Gideon refused to be their king. Why? Because he understood that God, at his command, said he, God, was to be the king. It was not to be a human king. He refused their offer of kingship, and basically he returned to private life after successfully leading the military campaign. And so there was no standing army. It was the militia of the several tribes, not states, but tribes. And, you know, when that militia was needed to defend the territory or to help defend other tribes in the nation as a whole, they were gathered together and led militarily by judges who were just raised up for that proportion of time. And, you know, after they fulfilled that role, there was no longer an ongoing position like the king of a nation. So it was highly decentralized, and basically the government functioned at the lowest levels, even in the tribes. In the tribes, each walled city, and you need to understand there was not only walled cities that were, you know, highly defensive protection, but there was villages outside of the walled cities that when, you know, marauding bands came or war was going on, then the people would leave their villages and they would go into the walled city for protection. And in those walled cities, at the gate of the city was where the government was centered. And it's important to note that these gates were, there was not a building. There was no governmental building at all. The court was held in the gate of the city and it was in the open air. We have the beautiful scene of the Book of Ruth where Boaz has to do some legal business in order to establish that he has the right to marry Ruth, the Moabitess, and to redeem the property that Ruth's family had lost. But anyway, he does this in the open air in the city gates, and the person he needs to do business with happened to be passing through the city gates, and he called them, come on over here, and you know, here's the witnesses, here's the judge, and we need to conduct this legal business in the open air. So every walled city, in a sense, was the center for the government of that area of the tribe. And so there wasn't really a great hierarchy of, okay, this walled city above that walled city. Each walled city, you know, would govern the area around it in a circumference until it reached the border, basically, of the next walled city. So a highly decentralized form of government, and a government that largely involved volunteers, that is, people who were not in paid positions. In fact, Scripture warns as part of the law of God that judges are not to be paid. Because if you pay a judge, it gets involved in bribing that judge. So who can pay the judge the most, you know, gets the decision they want. That's a violation of justice. So judges were unpaid. That's right. And jurors unpaid. It was a voluntary position, but it was one that you willingly engaged in, just like you willingly engaged in the militia when there was a danger, because you recognize that, like in a time of danger, when there's war, and the militia needs to gather together and go to war to defend the territory. So in the case where a judicial action is needed, where there's a case or controversy that's come before the people, that case or controversy is apt to undermine the rule of law in your area, in your tribe. And if you don't serve as a juror, if you don't do your part as you know, in the civic body politic there, what's going to happen is lawlessness is going to be abounding. And so it's not the job of somebody that you hire to see that law and order is followed and established. It's the job of every citizen. That's why every citizen needed to know the law of God, know what the standard of right and wrong was, and be willing to participate voluntarily, not paid, participate to see that justice was established. Or as the famous prophet Micah says, Amos says, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. The people were involved in making that happen. The government was very much of the people, and the people formed into the bodies that met temporarily whenever there was a need to establish justice, whenever there was a need to defend the territory. All the functions of government during the Hebrew Republic were very much on a volunteer basis, and the good citizens knew that if they didn't volunteer and if they didn't step forward, then their property rights might not be secure. So if their neighbor was having a dispute with his neighbor because one of the neighbors had moved the property boundary and was stealing land from his neighbor by doing that, and you were unwilling to serve as a juror in this dispute, well, what would happen when it came to somebody moving your property boundary? And so you realize you have a stake in justice being established, because if you don't work to establish justice for your neighbor, then nobody's going to be around to establish justice for you when you have a violation of God's law taking place. And this is a basic principle of God's word. The first law of God is love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is love your neighbor as yourself. And to love your neighbor meant that you sought justice for your neighbor when some violation of God's law had taken place in your neighbor's life or the life of his family. So when you think about that, that seems very foreign to us because we're used to having a professional government, professional lawyers and judges and, you know, prosecutors and police and all these things that in the Hebrew Republic, it was all volunteer. And therefore, the government was very inexpensive. The poorest person in the Hebrew Republic was able to pay the annual tax was just a small amount of money because the government really did not tax hardly at all. And that small amount was just to maintain a few things. And there were no employees, you know, there were no government bureaucracies who have pensions and all the rest of it involves with a very expensive government that we are under today in our country. So I think there's a great deal to learn from the Hebrew Republic. Bill, why don't you bring us your thoughts about the Glorious Revolution?
All right. Chronologically, the Glorious or Bloodless Revolution of 1688 to 1689 occurred in England during the period of the Dutch Republic, previously discussed. Britannica describes the events that led to the assumption of the English throne by William of Orange and his wife, Mary II of England. The Glorious Revolution in English history is the events of 1688-89 that resulted in the deposition of James II and the accession of his daughter Mary II and her husband William III, Prince of Orange and Stadtholder of the United Provinces of the Netherlands. After the accession of James II in 1685, this overt Roman Catholicism alienated the majority of the population. In 1687, he issued a declaration of indulgence, suspending the penal laws against nonconformists and recusants, and in April 1688, ordered that a second declaration of indulgence be read from every pulpit on two successive Sundays. William Sancroft, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and six other bishops petitioned him against this and were prosecuted for seditious libel. Their acquittal almost coincided with the birth of a son to James' Roman Catholic queen, Mary of Modena, and that was in June. This event promised an indefinite continuance of his policy and brought discontent to a head. Seven eminent Englishmen, including one bishop and six prominent politicians of both Whig and Tory persuasions, wrote to William of Orange, inviting him to come over with an army to redress the nation's grievances. William was both James' nephew and his son-in-law, and until the birth of James' son, William's wife, Mary, was heir apparent. William's chief concern was to check the overgrowth of French power in Europe. Between 1679 and 1684, England's impotence and the Emperor Leopold I's preoccupation with Turkish advances to Vienna had allowed Louis XIV to seize Luxembourg, Strasbourg, Casale Monferrato, and other places vital to the defense of the Spanish Netherlands, the German Rhineland, and northern Italy. By 1688, however, a great European coalition had begun to form to call for a halt to aggression. Its prospects depended partly upon England, thus having been in close touch with the leading English malcontents for more than a year. William accepted their invitation. Landing at Brixham on Torbay on November 5th, he advanced slowly on London as support fell away from James II. James' daughter Anne and his best general, John Churchill, were among the deserters to William's camp. Thereupon, James fled to France. Let's summarize what we have learned so far. We divided the subject of the history of civil government into two realms. The realm of faith is described in the Bible, and the secular realm. We saw a trend away from warrior-based monarchies to oligarchies beginning with the Golden Age of Athens. The rise of the commercial class, apparently by the time of the Italian republics did not change that tendency. Even when Switzerland and the Netherlands experimented with confederations, the tendency towards oligarchy and aristocracy could not be suppressed. Indeed, it was William III, Prince of Orange, who agreed to invade England in order to depose James II that marked the Glorious Revolution. As we examine civil government in England during this period, we need to be critical of the English government and whatever gulf remained between it and the ideal government described by John Locke in the Second Treatise of Government, suggested in the first session of the series. John Locke was hardly a disinterested observer of the Glorious Revolution, and the Second Treatise of Government may have been written as a justification for the Glorious Revolution. The examples of civil government used in this series are reasonable, but I'll admit that any attempt to use Locke's Second Treatise of Government is a theoretical ideal and has limitations. Certainly, Jefferson was impressed enough with Locke that the former's critics claimed he cribbed Locke's ideas in the Declaration of Independence. Yet even if we accept the idea that government of, by, and for the people is a good idea, is one person, one vote the right rule for assuring public officials will always act in the public interest? Today, we're overwhelmed with evidence to the contrary. Candidates appeal to the lowest and crudest interests of voters, limiting the vote to those who, with a certain amount of property, is no assurance that self-interest will not dominate elections. And to Americans, that idea seems eminently unjust. Perhaps granting the vote based upon civic knowledge would be more just, but there is little of that idea being discussed in the public square today. In this session, let's concentrate on the form of government created by the Glorious Revolution and its advantages and disadvantages, returning to the subject of just suffrage in the final session of the series. Britannica continues, William was now asked to carry on the government and summon a parliament. When this convention parliament met, January 22, 1689, it agreed, after some debate, to treat James' flight as an abdication and to offer the crown with an accompanying declaration of rights to William and Mary jointly. Both gift and conditions were accepted. Thereupon, the convention turned itself into a proper parliament and large parts of the declaration into a Bill of Rights. This bill gave the succession to Mary's sister Anne in default of issue from Mary, barred Roman Catholics from the throne, abolished the crown's power to suspend laws, condemned the power of dispensing with laws as it had been exercised and used of late, and declared a standing army illegal in time of peace. Abolishing the crown's power to suspend laws, condemned the power of dispensing with laws, were two steps in the direction of representative government. But Wikipedia has this to say about standing armies during that period. The Militia Act of 1661 prohibited local authorities from assembling militia without the approval of the king to prevent such a force being used to oppress local opponents. This weakened the incentive for local officials to draw up their own fighting forces, and King Charles II subsequently assembled four regiments of infantry and cavalry, calling them his guards, at a cost of £122,000 paid out of his regular budget. This became the foundation of the permanent British Army. By 1685, it had grown to 7,500 soldiers in marching regiments and 1,400 men permanently stationed in garrisons. The Monmouth Rebellion of This became the foundation of the British permanent British army. By 1685, it had grown to 7,500 soldiers in marching regiments and 1,400 men permanently stationed in the garrisons. The Monmouth Rebellion in 1685 provided James II with a pretext to increase the size of the force to 20,000 men. And there were 37,000 in 1688, when England played a role in the closing stage of the Franco-Dutch War. In 1689, William III expanded the army to 74,000 and then to 94,000 in 1694. Nervous at the power such a large force afforded the king, whilst under his personal command, Parliament reduced the cadre to 7,000 in 1697. Scotland and Ireland had theoretically separate military establishments, but they were de facto merged with the English force. The Bill of Rights in 1689 officially reserved authority over a standing army to Parliament, not the king. It doesn't sound like standing armies were ever eliminated. Wikipedia also has a comment that should make us question Adam Smith's image as a true free market person. In his influential work, The Wealth of Nations, 1776, economist Adam Smith comments that standing armies are a sign of a modernizing society, as modern warfare requires the increased skill and discipline of regularly trained standing armies. Standing armies are a fixture under the economic policy of mercantilism and the political policy of colonialism and imperialism. Let's take a look at the Bill of Rights that was created during this period. These are the rights specified in the English Bill of Rights. Freedom to elect members of Parliament without the king or queen's interference. And this was still a long distance from one person, one vote. Freedom of speech in Parliament, but not freedom of speech for the ordinary citizen. Freedom from royal interference with the law. This was an advance in popular government. Freedom to petition the king. Likewise, this was an advance in popular government. Freedom to bear arms for self-defense, an important advance in the rights of the citizen. Freedom from cruel and unusual punishment and excessive bail. Likewise, an advance in the rights of the citizen. Freedom from taxation by royal prerogative without the agreement of Parliament. Also an advance. Freedom of fines and forfeitures without a trial. Also an advance. Freedom from armies being raised during peace times. It is questionable whether this was ever truly implemented. Many of these rights found their way into the Bill of Rights incorporated into the Constitution of the United States. Let's look at William and Mary's government. After William and Mary were proclaimed joint sovereigns of Britain, who influenced the government? The question is difficult to answer using sources on the internet. Winston Churchill gives us some clues in The Age of Revolution. In that third volume of A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, he mentions names like the Earl of Danby, the Earl of Clarendon, John Churchill, who was promptly elevated to Earl of Marlborough for his support of William III during the Glorious Revolution, the Duke of Shrewsbury, Edward Russell, the first Earl of Orford, and Sidney Godolphin, the first Earl of Godolphin. When one pursues the association of Halifax with William III, Wikipedia reveals the first ministry of William III and Mary. Of the eight offices identified, only one is non-titled. The conclusion one draws is that the Glorious Revolution did not bring about government by the common man. If there were any doubt, it should be dispelled by this statement by Churchill concerning party contention between Whigs and Tories in the first government of William and Mary. The Whigs considered that revolution belonged to them. Their judgment, their conduct, their principles had been vindicated. Ought they not then to have all the offices? But William knew that he could never have gained the crown of England without the help of the Cavaliers and the High Churchmen, who formed the staple of the Tory party. Moreover, at this time, as a king, he liked the Tory mood. Here was a church dedicated to hereditary monarchy. William felt that Whig principles would ultimately lead to a republic. In summary, the Glorious Revolution was about sharing power between king and parliament, not about sharing power with the common man. And what about that bloodless revolution? The gift bestowed upon William of Orange made him King William III of England, Scotland, and Ireland. Irish Catholics said he was welcome to the first two titles, but they preferred the Catholic king, former king, James II. The matter was settled the old-fashioned way, employing the principle that might makes right. On July 1st, 1690, English forces under William of Orange, recently renamed William III of England, successfully engaged Irish and French forces under former King James II at the Battle of the Boyne. The Wheelwrights won a day, but the Irish retired to fight a year later at Aughrim, where Irish hopes were dashed. Thousands died on both sides in these two battles alone, so the Glorious Revolution could hardly be called bloodless. Less blood was spilled in the Highlands of Scotland by the Williamites, but far less honorable, Churchill relates. The darkest stain upon William's memory was to come from Scotland. A Highland clan, whose chief had been tardy in making his submission, was doomed to destruction by William's signature. The troops were sent to Glencoe to extirpate the den of thieves, but the horror with which this episode has always been regarded arises from the treacherous breach of the laws of hospitality by which it was accomplished. The royal soldiers lived for weeks in the valley with the clansmen, partaking of their rude hospitality under the guise of friendship. Suddenly, on a freezing winter night, they turned upon their hosts and murdered them by the score while they slept or fled from their huts. The king had not prescribed the method, but he bears the indelible shame of the deed. Again, the Glorious Revolution was not bloodless. Let's take another look at a byproduct of this era, the beginnings of central banking. It seems incredible to those who believe becoming King of England would be an ultimate lifetime goal that for William, it was essentially a sideshow. William's focus was on defeating his lifetime foe, Louis XIV, and reducing France's political power. His marriage to Mary and their joint possession of the throne of England drew England into continental conflict with the French, a costly conflict for both sides. In this situation, the Country Party, the Tories, had reservations about involvement in continental wars, whereas the Whigs were advocates. Funding by taxation through the House of Commons was becoming increasingly challenging. How could these wars continue to be funded under the circumstances? Britannica explains, year by year, the financial costs mounted. Between 1688 and 1702, England accumulated more than £14 million of debt, which was financed through the creation of the Bank of England in 1694. The bank was a joint stock company empowered to discount bills and issue notes. It lent to the government at a fixed rate of interest, initially 8%, and this interest was secured by a specific customs grant. Investors scrambled for the bank's notes, which were considered gilt-edged securities, and more than £1.2 million was raised on the initial offering. Not surprisingly, a growing funded debt created inflation and led to a financial crisis in 1696. Mises.org adds, the Bank of England went bankrupt after 2 years of operation in 1696 and survived because of government-granted suspension, suspension of payments. The English crown remained its main customer and granted additional privileges such as legal protection against the competition of other banks. Thus, the evil of central banking was introduced to the world. It gave governments increasing control over the money supply and encouraged them to spend beyond their means. Less understood is that central banks redistribute a nation's wealth from those who have ultimately accumulated it in the free market to special interests, such as those promoting war on the European continent, in the case of William and Mary III. Finally, let's talk about rotten boroughs and the connection to America's War of Independence. Government after the Glorious Revolution in Britain was not some kind of ideal arrangement in which all enjoyed the suffrage. Britannica describes how the votes were distributed, employing what has become known as rotten boroughs. Here is Britannica's definition of a rotten borough. It is a depopulated election district that retains its original representation. The term was first applied by English parliamentary reformers of the early 19th century to such constituencies maintained by the crown or by an aristocratic patron to control seats in the House of Commons. Just before the passage of the Reform Act of 1832, more than 140 parliamentary seats of a total of 658 were in rotten boroughs, 50 of which had fewer than 50 voters. Note that these statistics reflect voting in the 19th century and were probably worse in the late 18th century. The corruption associated with the British system was one reason British colonists in what became the United States, elected to secede from the British system of government. In summary, the British system of government, as it evolved from the Glorious Revolution, was a constitutional monarchy, and in that sense, an improvement over pure monarchy. It laid the groundwork for some individual rights, but these were not as comprehensive as those that would be subsequently described in the Bill of Rights in the Constitution of the United States. Fundamentally, the Glorious Revolution led to a greater concentration of political power in a national government, as its treatment of the Irish and Scots demonstrated. It was not government of, by, and for the people. Enigmatically, Locke's Second Treatise of Government was written as justification for the Glorious Revolution. That should caution us to look critically at the ideas that were stated there. We should not assume that the ideas stated in the Second
Thank you, Phil. It's very valuable to see all the details of William and Mary. Things that we don't often hear about what the reign of William and Mary involved for Ireland and Scotland as well. But one of the things I appreciate that was established here is that the people, through their elected representatives, but you're absolutely right, it was not a universal franchise, so it's not everyone voting on this, but the people were determining that, look, we don't want to have this type of king. James II is not the kind of king we want. We want to replace him and put someone in position who's going to better protect our rights than James II is doing. And they particularly, like you said, when the birth of that child, it was clear that, okay, the policies of James II are now going to be continued by a son who's going to take the throne after his death of his father and so on. So the thing that I note here is that this is an illustration that in the English mind, consent of the governed was essential for there to be the government, which is why our founders said, hey, you know, when King George III, really, they said he has abdicated his position as king, he unkinged himself by not fulfilling what the, Englishman's Bill of Rights requires of him, his oath to become king required of him, or what the Magna Carta required of him. The agreement between we the people and our king has been violated by the king. And the colonial charters were another objection in the Declaration of Independence. The king has violated and squashed these colonial charters. So the agreement we had, the king's no longer fulfilling that agreement. And so the mindset that is, being revealed here in the Glorious Revolution is that mindset that the consent of the governed is required for a government to go on governing its people. It's not just the power, so might makes right. It's the consent of the governed that we see arising here.
Yeah, I think if we look at the first three amendments that form the Bill of Rights, you see a difference between the English Bill of Rights and the Bill of Rights for the United States. Clearly, our Bill of Rights is more citizen-focused. The famous first, of course, freedom of religion and speech and press, assembly, and petition are all aimed specifically at protecting the individual, not members of the government. Likewise, the right to bear arms and freedom from having to quarter troops. All of that, I think, is a big distinction. If you look at the Glorious Revolution, it definitely was a step forward. The British are very proud of it, and legitimately so. And yes, it is an example of, in effect, a turning out of the king for not performing as the people had expected. That, too, is true. But when you come to the United States and its founding, and you see this issue with the rotten boroughs, the corruption in the British system was also a major reason why the citizens of the United States, who were at that time subjects of England, these citizens wanted to have nothing to do with that kind of a government. They realized that it was not truly representative. And so they were trying to create a government that did not have the faults of the Glorious Revolution. They also had to deal with the fact that they were creating a government that had to span a much larger geographic area than what is now the United Kingdom, and potentially a population that would be significantly greater than Britain's population. So they had a lot. They had quite a challenge.
The other thing I appreciate about what the Glorious Revolution was accomplishing is it abolished the crown's power to suspend laws, as you pointed out. The whole idea that one branch of government, this case the executive branch of government, would be the king, and the king could arbitrarily say, "Well, we're just going to suspend this, and we're going to suspend that. And those are not law right now." That is a huge leap forward, because the previous idea of the divine right of kings said, "Hey, basically, laws, whatever the king says, it is. He's in complete control here. You really can't object." This is saying, "No." There is a standard to which the king himself is beneath that standard. He's not above the standard of the law. He has no power to suspend the laws. And I, look at what took place in 2020 here in America. Governments all across our nation, with maybe one exception, I think it might have been the state of South Dakota, they suspended the rights of people. Some states suspended the right to travel. I remember a friend of mine issuing me a certificate that said that I was an essential employee, that therefore I could travel. This is, because the threat was that the police would pull you over if you were traveling on the road, say, "What are you doing out on the road? You're supposed to be home. You don't have any freedom to travel." It's like, wait a minute. We have a God-given right, freedom to travel. Freedom to travel is part of our system of law. And for the government to suspend these laws, say, "Oh, we got this emergency. This flu is on the run." No. They have no right to do that according to our U.S. Constitution and most state constitutions. But I love that this was birthed here in the midst of that glorious revolution to say, no. When laws are created, the power to suspend those laws is not in the hands of the executive branch. And, our U.S. Constitution, as well as many state constitutions, say if there's going to be any suspension of laws, it must happen by the legislature, not the executive branch. So, for example, suspending habeas corpus in our U.S. Constitution is something never granted to the executive branch. It's only the legislative branch in a time of dire emergency. They have to agree together. There has to be a process by which the representatives of the people decide about the suspension of law. So I appreciate that as what I would see as another advance that the Glorious Revolution brought about. And as we look at the Militia Act and the elements of the Englishman's Bill of Rights, we were blessed by this occurring just less than 100 years from the founding of our country, because our founders looked back to what was done in that Glorious Revolution and said, yes, this is something we the people have the right to do. Consent of the governed. We consent not to be governed by King George III because he's violating the law rather than protecting our rights. We have the right and power to do that. And again, looking at the Englishman's Bill of Rights, that was the birth in their mind of an idea that we need a Bill of Rights. Our Constitution never would have come into existence if the anti-federalists who objected to the fact that there was no Bill of Rights, if their objection had not been answered, there would not have been sufficient number of states to actually form the Union under the Constitution as we know it today.
I think it's interesting that the shutdown and ban on travel was not truly a partisan matter in the United States. It's not like the Democrats initiated or Republicans initiated. Yes, the Republican president did initiate it, but the whole idea was rapidly picked up by the governors of many of the states. So I think it's important to recognize
correct. In fact, that
the two-party system is not going to rescue
us. It makes it even harder to fight back against, because you don't have any representatives on your side, in a sense. Here's liberty, and both parties are opposed to this liberty, freedom to travel being one example. But another example would be the freedom to have a job. My people in my congregation that lost their jobs over the face diaper, not wanting to wear a face diaper or not wanting to get an experimental jab in the arm that nobody knew exactly what it was going to do. And it turned you into a human guinea pig, which is a violation of the Nuremberg Code. You can't experiment on human beings without fully informed consent. And there was no fully informed consent, but people were coerced. We had friends who were ejected from the military because they did not get the shot, and other people lost their jobs. People, businesses were crushed by what was taking place in that time, where basically our God-given rights were thrown in the trash can. Oh, there's a virus afoot. We got to throw everybody's rights away, and you have no freedoms any longer. And sadly, too many Americans went along with that because they don't understand this whole idea of freedom, and that we have these God-given rights, and the purpose of government to protect those God-given rights, not to protect your health. You know, you're the one who can protect your health with what you choose to do, and the government is to protect your liberty and freedom to protect your own health. It's not their job to be the nanny state and protect your health.
You know, we got ourselves into a real bind where we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. Obviously, government created a severe problem with its shutdown policies, and it became apparent, you know, that we were not able to produce the things on which we rely. And the answer was pure Keynesianism, which was, and this was initiated by President Trump and joyfully jumped on by the Democrats as well. But they said, oh, all we need to do is to create demand by creating more more money, more counterfeit money. And so we had the stimulus. Now, the stimulus was used at least a decade earlier when we had a financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. And it was interesting in the sense that you saw the limitations of representative government. The people, probably 75% of them, rejected the idea of bailing out the banks at that point. So the lesson was learned on the politicians, who ignored the people, by the way. The lesson was learned, gee, if we try that again, you know, we're going to get thrown out of office. And so they said, well, let's widen the net. Instead of just bailing out a special group, let's bail out everybody. Everybody will get a check. And so we had this immense program. There were three acts, two under Trump and one under Biden. Three of these in total. And when you add all of those up, you look at the cost of the legislation and you ask, who benefited? Well, for every $1 that went into the pocket of an ordinary citizen, and ordinary citizens got somewhere around $3,200, I think, altogether, and with the three bailouts, if you will. So if you look at that, for every dollar that went into the pockets of an ordinary individual, $8 went into the pockets of special interests. I mean, if we were deluded in 2008 and 2009,
and the sad thing is most Americans didn't realize what's really happening, like you say, it's because they're creating this money out of thin air. Anybody who saved, anybody who invested, anybody who wisely handled their finances was being robbed, because all of this just simply contributes to inflation. And so you had $100 in the bank, and now that $100 has been reduced. So various estimates, some upwards to say maybe 12 to 15% per year. So just add that up, 12 to 15% since 2021. You just add those 3 years together of say, okay, that means you just lost 45% of the value of the money that you had in the bank. And we're now seeing what that looks like with rampant inflation happening all around us. You go to the grocery store, it used to be, you know, you could fill your basket for a certain amount of money. You now look and say, whoa, same amount of money, I can't even come close to filling the basket like I did 3 years ago. So we see inflation as the result. But the sad thing is most people don't make that connection. And that's a shame.
Yeah, we have put ourselves into what Alistair MacLeod calls a debt trap. The interest rates were artificially lowered, and now they have to be increased. And that increases the cost of borrowing by the government. And so, you know, it just gets tougher and tougher. The only way to get out of the debt trap is to significantly reduce the amount of government spending,
as indeed what we need here, rather than Argentina, spending trillions upon trillions, which the Biden administration continues to do. Well, we as the people, we need to understand these principles, and we need to hold our elected officials accountable, which is why we're teaching this series here at We the People, The Constitution Matters. We invite you to join us next Friday morning, 8 a.m. Also, check out our website, 1180wfyl.com. Click on podcast. The very bottom podcast is We the People, years of material that can help educate Americans so that we can restore our constitutional republic.